The Cave by Gareth Stack. This work is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, which means you're free to listen to it and share it in any format you wish. However, it must not be remixed, altered, or used for any commercial purpose without permission. Thanks. The warm breath of a train as it passes by. Streaks of orange and black and porthole glimpses of the hollow centre of each carriage. The lingering stink of failure. He presses close to the jet stream, close to the sharp edges and jagged protuberances of steel and plastic. Hundreds of tons of thunder, a shell of blind kinetic fury, skipping by as if weightless. He tastes ash and carbon, and somewhere in the centre of his head, pounding heart of pus begins to throb. Dead cell angels mix and drift against the too bright and too big cabin lights as he edges closer, closer. And it's past, and the station's empty save for the settling of unfastened props. A vacant stage. Ray steps back, twists a hand and flexes stiffened fingers free from red and purpled palms.
Monston's magic heavy pills make the stain of existential crisis disappear. It's a miracle.
He turns slow and sharp, face hot and reddening, legs awkwardly sensitive, calves taut and clenching. What? The midget perches on the cusp of a flaking blue bench. Tiny, his feet dangle inches off the ground, leading up to bundles of tweed and a shock of red satin waistcoat. A piebald head perches neckless on his shoulders.
It's what you're looking for, or am I wrong? Your eyes agree. It's why you didn't jump.
Ray's face itches around clenched teeth. What's your problem? He spits like a thumb twister, meant as a bellow, emerging a whisper. The tiny thing descends with a hop, light on thick but tidy legs, and steps up to Ray's side. His round, pink head shakes in its starched grey collar, threatening to roll off. Pug features crunch into a tight smile, a grin that's half a grimace.
Not a problem, a solution.
He reaches from a depth of cloak and suit and draws out a slight pink hand adorned with fine white cuticles. Quick and certain, he grabs Ray, stepping the pair off the platform. Forward they topple, Ray backward and flailing, tumbling over his shoulder on impact, face in the gravel, head ringing from the thump of a rail. The little man on all fours, shaking himself, turning and grinning inches from Ray's rising eyes, teeth seeming jagged, sharpened, twisting his body to face Ray and leaping awkwardly for him as though something inside is broken. Ray turning and shifting his weight to keep the snapping, jabbering teeth back from his face, batting at the vicious thing with his free arm and launching back onto the platform.
Hollow and aching, empty and swollen, the taste of iron in your mouth, shuffling about like drunken toys.
The midget still on the tracks, voice shrill and keening, eyes reflective and enormous in the darkness. He's snapping at the air, but makes no move to follow. Ray keeps backing up, turns into a run. The voice pursues, unholy, accusatory.
Relax, Ray. Just relax and continue. Fucking relax. Why don't I?
You were describing...
Are you familiar with the homunculus?
I do have a doctorate, Ray. Yeah, but in psychology, right? Not medicine. Cognitive neuroscience, actually. Right, fine. Start with that. Invert the skin. Make the eyes bigger. Make them bulbous and yellowed. Huge. You've seen pictures of what Agent Orange does. I'm afraid I haven't. Well, read up on it or don't. It's fucked. And the lips are absent, correct? Dr. Phillips mentioned that's consistent. It's all consistent. You don't change. It's not dreamy. It's not random. No lips, no teeth, no gums. Barely a jaw, in fact. We can take a break, if you'd like. Your galvanic skin response is extremely high. No, let me finish. It's what I see. It shouldn't be so difficult to describe. Your mouth... Your jaw is almost non-existent. Twisted and shrunken. It doesn't look capable of speech. But you hear us, Ray. You follow what I'm saying. You're coherent. How am I speaking to you? It's not... How you speak is not normal. Your tongue is overlarge like your head. It twists and wraps around too much. It kind of licks the words out of your upper jaw, and it sounds watery and duplicated, as if there's more than one voice. Like a murder of crows. Very poetic, Ray. The house feels tight, clutched to the ground. Gnarled floorboards, aching sweet sweat, honey varnish into the creaking, cooling morning. Shadows of the pre-dawn clouds flicker and scatter pale blues and deep grey streaks through the open blinds onto the lightning bedroom ceiling. Still warm and shaky, in tight damp suit and loose but choking tie, he lies, too weak to rise, tracking the progress of the morning on the shadows of the ceiling's hanging dapples. The night has taken refuge in the dank black magic of the bedroom's open doorway, stirring and broiling beyond the foot of the resting bed. He shifts his view, edging back on neck and shoulders to eye the itching portal of the doorframe. A creaking rises, growing slowly to a deepening growl of straining wood against dead wood. Beyond the doorway, something is moving. He grits his teeth and shakes slowly, moving with paralytic stiffness. Sweat roughens the grip of the cheap suit's hardened collar, and his neck twists against the stiff, coarse fabric, tearing strips from wet and dirty skin. A shape emerges from the doorway, sharp curved and stenciled in the taut wet darkness. It grinds into the room, the agonizing protest of stretched timber oiling its path, a soft curving form with loose fluttering skin breaking from the black. He presses back onto the bed, leans hard into the headboard, skull swiveling, twisting away, but pupils locked onto the grinding moaning mass of wood and cloth as it inches forward. Softly the fibrous mass begins to whisper, a rising hiss above the groan of stressed and aching wood. Black words and tongues coil and slink around Ray's feet as the headless thing heaves up onto the stiff and creaking mattress. Words that serve to bind his neck awkwardly to the perpendicular headboard and affix his flaccid limbs in place, impotent to resist their Lovecraftian potency. Its shape is clearer now. Wasp-waisted and broad-shouldered, capped with a flat, headless neck stump. The curved maternal form is pinned and cloaked with strips of pleated tartan, jacketed with plaid, and mottled with frayed rips of Burberry. Ray's drooling now, eyes sore and dry but scalded open, yearning to roll back, to peel away from this thing like the skin of his face which pulls off his skull in a grinning rictus. Brown and stinking of oak, screaming hoarse pugnant whispers against the morning, hauling mist-black tongues of fur-coat darkness with it, the monster mounts him.
So why can't I remember? It's completely discontinuous. I mean, I know to some degree who I am and what things should be like, even if they aren't, but it's as though anything before the last few days is a torn patchwork of images and conversations. We're not sure, eh? Some degree of retrograde amnesia is normal with any psychosurgery. Additionally, you've undergone such a new procedure that we can't be certain of its ultimate effect. So it's possible I might never remember. There's every reason to believe your memories will return, but a permanent deficit is certainly a possibility we can't discount. Don't tell me that. My memories are who I am. I'm sorry, Ray, but we have every hope of a full recovery. But you still haven't explained the delusions, hallucinations, or whatever they are. It's a rather involved explanation, Ray. We've been more concerned with tracking the progress of your recuperation. What recuperation? Things still look like this. You're awake and conscious, Ray. Any improvements will take time. A degree of depression is to be expected. Try not to let it engulf you. With this treatment, perhaps more than any other, your expectations play a role in directing the outcome. Dr. Phillips, what I see is not normal. In your case, Ray, there is no normal. The synthetic neurotrophic we've given you is having an enormous impact on your brain's development. It could, in theory, have had any number of suboptimal side effects. To an extent, the positive schizotypal hallucinations you're experiencing are relatively benign. Hallucinations? Perhaps. If you could see what I see. Pardon me? The terrifying thing, Doctor, is not so much the images, but the thought that my mind could produce such things. Or worse, the thought that they could be real. Actually, Ray, that's more than an idle conjecture. Your fMRI reveals an enormous amount of neuronal development and synaptic activity, in many cases in parts of the brain that wouldn't normally experience the growth of new neurons beyond infancy. Your brain, and by inference your mind, is unprecedented. You're struggling to conceptualize perceptions you may be the first to have experienced. So now you're saying they're not hallucinations. The monstrosities. There, outside the window, the vast black tongue licking at the land. The steel and glass lattices of the false animals. This constricting structure of suckling egg sacs and coiling fecal worms is genuinely what keeps me bound to the bed. This is real. Well, try to stay calm, Ray. It's not so simple. What you need to do is understand the difference between sensation, the information you receive from sensory neurons in your skin, your eyes, ears, and the rest of your sensorium, and perception, the process by which your mind constructs a world, a reality from those sensations. You mean the difference between reality as it is and my perception of it? Not exactly right. Let me try to explain more succinctly. You've seen those Edinburgh documentaries where they demonstrate the wide-angle view of the eagle or the wider colour sensitivity of the bumblebee. Of course, yeah, I've seen programs like that. Well, in both those cases, the nervous system of the animal is equipped with eyes that function as extremely sensitive imaging devices and that are partially responsible for that species' richer experience. But we could take another case, something like the wolf, where in addition to a specialised sensory snout, the brain possesses a highly developed interpretive device, a large olfactory bulb, which constructs an impression of the world qualitatively different from anything we can imagine. It's not any more or less real than our experience of the world. It's simply different. Huxley's doors of perception. You're suggesting I have a more accurate perception of reality? Like a sixth sense? In a way, perhaps, but of course, the changes in your central nervous system are less like specifically evolved adaptations and more akin to quasi-random mutations. To a very real extent, we can't be certain how much though your brain's attempt to accommodate a nonsensical stream of perceptual activity it wasn't designed to deal with. Like the nightmares I've been having. Like all dreams, perhaps. I could, for example, argue that you're bound to your bed with hospital-issue straps, that your movements are restricted because you've been experiencing seizures, increasing your risk of hemorrhage. But, of course, it's equally possible that on some alternate conceptual level, things are entirely different.
It starts like any ordinary dream. Ray's at a garden party, surrounded by tipsy, smirking dignitaries, kowtowing to one another, vicious behind dead eyes. He wanders through the unkempt grass under a slate-grey sky, wondering at the wildness of the garden. Around him, mimes test the boundaries of imaginary boxes, and silk-mantled jugglers on stilts disturb the waiters, striding over them like Martians from the War of the Worlds. Ray walks on, the earth becoming cracked and dry, dead like an African plain, till up ahead the throne rises from the soil, twisted and organic, Geiger-esque, with the frozen writhing forms of conger eels. Ray sits, in his arms a manuscript, yellowed and stinking, illuminated with a strange glyph, which somehow he must read. A crowd gathers, separating from the party, summoned through the black words which pour from Ray, unbidden and incomprehensibly eloquent. Each begins to move, shuffling in a dread pattern akin to a musicless dance set to the heathen rhythm of the manuscript. Across the width of a room, the grass of the garden begins to brown and shrivel. Trees shake and twist like broken marionettes. Marquees collapse and sink into the drying dusty soil. The dancers jerk faster to Ray's hacking rhythm, and beneath the earth a steady murmur grows. Vague in the dim brackish light, Ray makes out a movement on the horizon. Immense and swift, it approaches on a tight parabola, a billowing comet tail of dust and smoke signing its passage. Details emerge as it draws closer, form like a snake, a rough carapace of concentric rings, a great yawning shark-toothed maw. Then it's upon them, slipstream tsunami, a pounding flack of dust and rocks and swarms of tossed headless crickets, which push into Ray's ears, up his nasal cavity, and down his throat, powerless to stop the torrent of hellish words.
The worm coils itself, hard outer shells grinding against one another, draws up to strike cobra-like, then pounces and consumes him.
He trekked to a lost temple in the Andes, surviving for months on a Spartan diet of roots and berries. Free solo climbed thousands of feet of sheer vertical rock face, single-handedly defeated dozens of ninja monks, trained from birth on a regime of poetry and ultraviolence, and solved an ancient and cryptic riddle, recovering in the process the Tetragrammaton, the true name of God, which he used to feed the hungry, establish world peace,
and returned to life in golem form, a decomposing Bill Hicks. Sorry, Peter, I couldn't resist. Never ask a writer to produce his own obituary. It's amusing stuff, Ray. We may even print it. Might want to tone down the religious references, but fuck it. Here I am talking like a critical editor to one of my oldest and most esteemed friends. Can I get you a juice, or are you going to live up to my lowest expectations? Glenfiddich on the rocks, you sycophantic prick. Go easy, Ray. That's the only one you're getting. I don't know what kind of crazy medley of medications they're feeding you. Bloody Californians. You won't be happy till we're all drowning in beta-carotene and visiting our alchemists to have curses put on our pet psychiatrists. No, you don't actually. Not quite, Ray. I try not to entirely conform to cliché. Unlike some inebriate Booker Prize winners I could mention, better to pass boldly into that other world, in the full glory of some passion, than fade and wither dismally with age. Better be a character than a footnote, I say. If I was ever anything, I was a character. No past tense. I won't have it. You've got every chance of... No, Peter, I don't. The procedure's never even been attempted before. I actually have very little in the way of chances. Then why do it? You could have years left. Live out your life with Siobhan and the kids. Because of what it is. Sure, the diagnosis is early. Certainly there are drugs they can give me to delay the onset of symptoms. Well then... No. You know I nursed my father through the same thing. 4 years of gradual degeneration, of mood swings and tantrums. Dressing him the first morning he couldn't recognize me, feeding him as he spit the food back at me, cleaning him when he soiled himself. No one should die like that. I won't put Siobhan through it. And I won't let myself sink into a soulless delirium. So instead you're committing suicide? Far from it, my friend. I'm taking a chance. A chance at a real life. At worst, a chance at a dignified passage.
Rising to infinity, shelves upon shelves, stacked amuck like giant alphabet blocks. A cool breeze drifts from on high, carrying loose sheets with scrambled writing and blurred images that seem half familiar. Each pile of shelves is spaced a few feet apart in narrow corridors with gaps unevenly spaced between them. Ray wanders along one, half dizzy with the scale, half lucid of his dreaming state. From the distance, animal moans shudder, carried by the vibration of the cases. Gradually, Ray becomes aware the cases are not empty, but filled from floor to ceiling with a crazed menagerie of preserved and desiccated creatures. Each is unreadably labelled with some obtuse script, but a few he recognises, poking from the mass of strange and foreign carcasses. In one case, the angels of the sea are gathered, pale dragonettes, hooked as if fresh caught, Gallerinu gallius, half remembered from projected films in the dusty yellow classrooms of Ray's childhood. Another holds the demons of the deep, the alien forms of the Atlantic football fish, bloated and purpled, freakish. Suspended in a third hang the shark. Some he remembers, the great bulk of Cedaranus maximus, the basking shark, massive and still, poised as if to strike, the sleek and tiny but vicious taupe. A few confound him, one red-bellied monster seeming closer to a great stickleback, yet with a head that seems all teeth and three eyes incongruously set above its mouth. Almost without noticing, Ray reaches the corridor's finish, the passage bookended by another greater case. Different and infinitely larger than the rest, it rises unbroken above him, so that were it not for the thin, diffuse light which seems to drip rather than shine, concealing distant forms, it would dominate the leering vastness of the place. Ray stops, preparing himself to look, head fuzzy with histamines and the thick drifting smog of dead skin, which makes him blink and sniffle like a wretch before this thing. He clears his eyes, scraping them with grimy palms and stares, noticing the slow shifting forms. This case holds life. Billions of soft twisting tunnelling shapes slither over one another, clinging to the vertical wall of the display. Each seems displaced somehow. Ray can tell they're not to scale, though they vary in length from a finger to a forearm, their constant movement, a wet scratching susurrus. Ray listens closely, pressing an ear to the cool surface of the case, the glass misting from his breath, the voices whispering, almost below the threshold of awareness.
It's a parasite, Taenia solium, one of the few planarian-like microscopic worms which can eat its way through the blood-brain barrier of the meninges, gnawing through the soft turf of grey matter, multiplying pathogenically till it forms a web, a network of stiffening cysts which attach themselves to the brain's ventricle cavities, leading to headaches, nausea, altered mental states, to seizures, and ultimately to agonizing death.
And you took this from his blood?
Cerebrospinal fluid. We did a spinal tap to check his neurotransmitter levels.
Jesus, how could we have missed this?
We screwed up. All the symptoms could have had their origin in the Alzheimer's or the neurotrophic. It's something he could have carried for years. There was no evidence of parasitic infestation. Perhaps the Alzheimer's triggered the hatching of the eggs. Maybe it was the drug. Infestation can be detected easily enough. It's just not something we ever thought to look for.
Have you informed him yet?
He hasn't regained consciousness. If he's lucky, he won't awake.
You've been listening to The Cave by Gareth Stack. This work is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, which means you're free to listen to it and share it in any format you wish. However, it must not be remixed, altered, or used for any commercial purpose without permission. Thanks.